The first case on the Southern Panel's oral argument today is case number 81862. Is the correct pronunciation Juan Arce? Okay. And Patricia Sanchez, is that right? Okay. All right, are you ready to go, counsel? I understand we might be having some microphone difficulties. I guess the clerk has discussed that with you, so you may need to speak up. And
thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is today's issue really involves a settlement of personal injury actions. There aren't many issues at dispute in how that settlement goes. Counsel for the plaintiff in the underlying case contacted the adjuster and the insurance company directly and negotiated a settlement. The main question for this court is whether or not such a contact by counsel to an adjuster and an insurance company, in that order, the insurance company has appointed counsel for insured, is it proper communication? And so where we start there is with the rule of professional conduct 4.2. It precludes an attorney from contacting any person that they know to be represented about the matter for which that person is being represented. The question then becomes, is that insurance adjuster the person who is represented by counsel for purposes of the personal injury action? This has been decided very clearly by this court, the primary case being Nevada Double Cab Corporation versus 8th Judicial District Court. In that case, this court says, we now expressly adopt the majority rule concerning the relationship between an insurer and counsel retained by the insurer to defend its insured. In absence of a conflict, counsel represents both the insured and the insurer. So in this case, Eric Storm, who is representing the main defendant in the underlying lawsuit, was retained by Key Insurance to represent the defendant. That makes the insurance company, under that tripartite relationship, a represented party. That means that any communication that any attorney wishes to have, either with the main defendant himself or with the representative of the insurance company, must go through the attorney. It is unequivocal that that did not happen here. Now, there is some mention in the briefs that the Nevada Yellow Cab case doesn't really apply to this situation because that was the case determining whether or not there was a disqualified attorney and not whether or not you could contact an insurance adjuster directly to settle the case. I would submit that it really doesn't matter. Because the first thing that you have to do in determining whether or not to disqualify an attorney is determine if there is an attorney-client relationship. So if that step doesn't exist, if there was no attorney-client relationship, then you wouldn't have to get any further in disqualification because there would be no basis for disqualifying the attorney because they didn't represent the insurance company.
So in this case, are there any facts to support the argument that Mr. Arce's counsel also represented the insurance company and had been retained by the insurance company?
Yes. So the insured, Mr. Arce, was being represented by Mr. Storm through, at the time, Storm Legal Group on assignment from Key Insurance. Storm Legal Group was staff counsel for Key Insurance Company. The name of the firm is now changed, but we remain staff counsel for the insurance company, and there was no doubt that Mr. Storm represented both the insured, Mr. Arce, as well as had been retained by the insurance company to represent him. It was a motor vehicle accident that was proceeding under recovery for an automobile insurance policy.
What is meant by staff counsel? I mean,
sure.
In-house counsel, employees of Key Insurance.
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
And I think that moving on from the Nevada Yellow Cab, even if there's some question as to whether or not that's applicable to a situation such as when we're talking about here today, where it really is more like respondent tries to argue in its brief that it's a disqualification issue only. I would point the court to State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company versus Hansen, 131 Nevada 743, 2015. In that case, as I'm sure the court is aware, this court considered whether or not an insurance company has to appoint independent counsel where there is a conflict between the insured and the insurance company. And in evaluating that, the court looked at Chima's case out of California and reasoned that some states don't require an independent counsel because in those courts, the sole client is the insured and therefore counsel owes only a duty to the insured.
Counsel, before we move on to that case, I don't believe you raised Yellow Cab in your opening brief, and in the reply brief, it was abandoned, your reliance on Yellow Cab. So today, are you now bringing up Yellow Cab?
Yes, Your Honor. I did not remember, not sure as to why counsel didn't include that. It was, if you look at underlying motion, the first basis. Right. The opposition was the first basis for why the court should not enforce this.
But in the opening brief, it was not raised, and in the reply brief, it was abandoned. Is that correct?
I did not see a reply brief. If it was, I apologize. It should not have been abandoned. I think it is the controlling case, and like I said, it was the first basis of the opposition of the court's decision in the underlying motion in terms of why this settlement was deployed.
You agree? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to, along the lines of what Justice Stiglitz was saying, I think the appellate brief said, quote, Yellow Cab has nothing to do with the issues that arose in this matter. So I don't know why counsel that wrote the brief would take that position if you're saying now the Yellow Cab applies directly to this matter.
I think it does to the extent that what we're talking about is the attorney-client relationship between an insurance company and the attorney signed by the insurance company to represent their insured, because that becomes the crux of whether or not this was a proper settlement. I do agree with the respondent that there has been no dispute that the adjuster and the insurance company did agree to settle the case for $10,000. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that if you decide that this was proper contact, that settlement wasn't reached. It's just that it isn't a discussion that should have ever occurred.
I have another question, but before I do that, I kind of interrupted Justice.
Go ahead, Ken.
What responsibility does the adjuster have if they're contacted by opposing counsel to contact counsel for appellant to say, hey, by the way, they want to settle this. I'm talking to them. Do you have any input you want to give me or any thoughts or opinions or questions?
I think in a perfect world, that is what would happen. We're obviously not always talking about adjusters that have the same level of experience. And I guess what I would equate it to is you can't really put the onus back on the person who's being improperly contacted. I guess what I would say is in reverse, if I contacted a personal injury client or plaintiff as an attorney representing the defendant and started talking to the plaintiff about settling the case, should that person have to say, wait, stop, talk to my attorney, or is it incumbent upon the attorney to not make that contact in the first place, knowing that it's improper to contact the represented party without first at least contacting the attorney and saying, do I have your permission to speak directly?
Understood, but that's a little apples to oranges because you're talking about a personal injury plaintiff that maybe has one event in their lifetime where they have to end up in court in some type of lawsuit versus insurance adjusters who, for a living, are involved in these kinds of things on a daily, multiple times basis, right?
That is true. But I think that at the bedrock of all of our legal principles is the attorney-client relationship is sacrosanct. And I don't think that we necessarily want to start getting into who's sophisticated enough that an attorney can contact them directly and they should know, well, I should go talk to my attorney or get some input from that person before I reach settlement. For instance, if I get into a motor vehicle accident with Dana White, do we then start going, it's okay for my attorney to contact Mr. White directly because he's a very sophisticated person, works on multi-million or billion-dollar deals. If we're talking about $10,000 personal injury settlement with him, he can handle that. He can be sophisticated enough to make a suing. I would still say, even in that case, no, that person is known to be represented by counsel in regard to the matter that which they're discussing with that person. And Rule 4.2 prohibits that unless you first get the permission of the attorney who represents that person.
Well, maybe. Here's the question. There are some states, including commentary out of Utah and others, where that issue may arise, where there has been notification of counsel that the lawyer in this instance, for our say, represents the insurance company, and or there is an instruction to the defendant's counsel not to communicate directly with the adjuster because of that representation. It's not clear to me that any of those communications were ever made.
I can tell you that a letter.
We've looked at the record. You cite me a place in the record where counsel for the insurance company, the storm firm, or even the insurance company for that matter, told the plaintiff's lawyer, we're represented by the insurance company, or we're representing the insurance company, and you're not to communicate with the insurance company.
I can't point you to something that specifically went out to that. But again, I don't necessarily believe that that is required because, one, we are talking about in-house staff counsel. So it is somebody who works for the insurance company. It is known amongst the bar that that is what staff counsel is for.
Well, wait a minute. There's nothing in the record that indicates that plaintiff's counsel knows who you work for?
I would agree that there is nothing specifically in the record that went out that said we represent for insurance, key insurance, other than the letters that go out from our office do say that the attorneys are employees of the key insurance company, just as many other insurance companies do. I'm not aware of any instance in which, in any case, whether I was in-house counsel or I was assigned a case by another insurance company where a letter has gone out saying I represent the insurance company, and generally the way the case gets from the insurance company to the attorney in the first place is that the copy of the complaint will be sent to the insurance company, and it's then sent to the attorney who's assigned because publication may be done through the DMV or some other method, so the person who's the actual defendant never is able to either send it to the insurance company or have it sent out. But in these types of cases, it's...
So I'm trying to... I don't want to interrupt you because... And I want to give you a full opportunity, of course, to comment on this, but I'm trying to separate what appears to be arguments even made by your opponent here about course and practice as opposed to what the record actually demonstrates. And we confine ourselves to the record. I understand that how lawyers practice in Clark County and the state of Nevada generally may differ from what is actually here, but when you get into these narrow questions, a lot of these issues turn on things that this record doesn't seem to establish. That's why I'm trying to clarify it. So I get where you're coming from. I really do appreciate the fact that in the industry, defense industry, plaintiff's bar, you all operate in some norms, but these things don't get documented, so the record doesn't run consistent with some of these cases or the commentary in some of these rule provisions.
I appreciate that. And you're right. I can't point you to a letter that says Storm Legal Group represents both the insurer and the insured. Again, the way these cases proceed.
Yeah. Here's the problem.
And
frankly, your opponent's going to get a similar question because his commentary is similar. You know, it's custom and practice that we communicate directly with adjusters. Well, that may be true, but where in the record is that authorized? When you've got a rule of professional conduct in Nevada that says you're not supposed to be communicating with represented parties.
Well, Your Honor, it says representative persons.
Yeah.
Not parties. So that's fair. A little bit of a distinction, because I agree, the insurance company did not get the target.
Yeah.
But again, plaintiff has had discussions pre-litigation. They sent demands pre-litigation mm-hmm. to the insurance company. I don't think they'll deny that they did. I don't think they'll deny that they had conversations with the insurance company pre-litigation. It then gets sent in litigation and in turn gets assigned to it. Is there a formal, and that may be something that going forward, we're going to have to do, specifically advising not only that we represent the insured, but that we represent the insurance company. But I think it's, again, well known that when you have an automobile accident, you have counsel assigned to it that it's being done by the insurance company. Thank you.
Just want to clarify. There's nothing in the record that represents that counsel also represents the insurance company, correct? Your proffer that is the case, notwithstanding the record, is Golden Gate. The case Golden Gate, correct? A case that you did not pursue in your opening brief. And I misspoke earlier. You did not file a reply. Is that correct? Is that where we are? Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Crafton.
Morning, Justice. May I please support Mr. Bryce Crafton? It's an honor to be here for you this morning. I have the pleasure of representing the Senate still on this matter, and as you notice, a review of Judge Alice exercise of discretion and grant our motion to defeat the errant judgment that's filed post-settlement and our chief of course the settlement grant. Judge Alford ruled that it was a valid and binding settlement agreement as of 2020 that consisted of an offer, acceptance, reliance, and performance. And the appellant has not shown justifiable reason to overturn her sound discretion. Judge Duff out did not dispute or abuse that discretion or the settlement judge. This court still subscribes to the long-held standard that only clear warned by the district court established the principles without apparent justification may constitute an abuse of discretion. The court also has inherent authority to correct a record and to right or wrong as long as it's been established in every court record in its records. So as to make them speak the truth, and that's what Judge Powell did. And we called Ms. Cervantes, or rather my partner called Ms. Cervantes and said, we're going to file a short trial request unless we can get this done. He was speaking with somebody who had knowledge, who was experienced, who was an employee of Key Insurance. Mr. Storm is also an employee of Key Insurance. He said right in the affidavit, this part of the I think it's the second paragraph. I am an employee, where he says, I have been employed by Key Insurance since 2016, and he has signed case by, in this case, Cervantes.
So when they say employed by, is that in-house counsel or a firm that represents a number of insurance, is tapped to represent a number of insurers?
Thank you for your question, Justice. That is in-house counsel. Well, they are employed by Key Insurance. They exclusively handle cases by Key Insurance. It is, and that's what that Mr. Storm's affidavit suggests. It's also Ms. Cervantes' affidavit. The question
is your does the record reflect that your partner knew that at the time they communicated with the adjuster?
That he knew that they were in-house counsel.
And that they were employed by Key Insurance.
Your Honor, I don't believe that affidavit that is in the record suggests that, but it was something that our chief judge found that is insurance or that Mr. Strunk's firm was in-house counsel for Key Insurance.
And you didn't take exception to that representation below, and you don't take exception to that now?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, are you contending otherwise? Do you contend otherwise that your partner didn't know about this or did know about this? Which is it?
No, I'm positive he knew.
Okay.
Because we have been partners for 10 years. Michelle was the insurance the entire time.
Okay.
I understand that Key Insurance's attorneys, just like Mr. Vinci, are employees. They're not retained. And I understand that Yellow Cab wasn't mentioned in their opening brief for some purposes, but then I did mention in my reply brief or my answer brief. It's important, but I think there's a vast difference between retained counsel and employed counsel. Retained counsel and insurance company retained counsel. There's discussion, negotiation. There is a contract signed by the insurance company and the attorney saying, here's the scope of our representation. Insurance company, we're asking you, attorney, to represent our insurer under these specific parameters. And there's a feeling that can occur on both sides. In-house counsel, for lack of a better term, not to be proud about it, but cases are just shipped down the hall. Assigned by Ms. Cervantes, which she says in her affidavit, to Mr. Storm in this case, as they do. Ms. Cervantes is not an unlearned party. She is a practice for Storm states in his affidavit, it's part of the record, that he answers to, reports to, is the word uses, to Ms. Cervantes. They are not represented parties, as was the case in the IC in the Nevada Yellow Cap versus a judicial district court dealing with the ICW insurance company. In that case, there was a specific set of facts where the lawyer, who eventually was disqualified along with the firm, represented ICW on behalf of Nevada Yellow Cab, switched jobs, switched firms, and now was part of the firm that was suing ICW on behalf of Nevada Yellow Cab in that same very case. That's vastly different than what we have here. What we have here is an arbitration award that was defense award. 9 days after the award, Mr. Deaver, who handled the negotiation with Ms. Cervantes prior to filing the complaint, casually to me said, hey, I have a good relationship with Eric. I called her vice versa. It's our first name. We call her. We'll see if we can get this done without having to move any further. And that's what he did. And when he called Ms. Cervantes in the transcript, in the record, also the audio as well as the transcript, by a brief, you can see that Ms. Cervantes isn't unlearned about this. She's not ignorant in how to handle this case. She knew that she had assigned counsel back in 2019, which is the state of the year. She knew that the case was in litigation. She knew that Mr. Storm was who she assigned it to, because there was a large portion of the transcript that doesn't read on paper, but certainly it is viewed in the audio, where she is reviewing notes. Back in her affidavit in the transcript, she says that, I'm sorry, not her affidavit in the transcript, which was transcribed, she says, let me look at the notes, let me look at the supervisor's comments. She doesn't mention any legal notes. She actually assumed that they're there. This is 9 days after a defense award was handed down, but she still doesn't know about the award and how the arbitrator ruled. When Mr. Dieter called her, by the way, he is a man of integrity and honor who would never violate 4.2 and take it very, very seriously. When he calls her, I believe it's clear to see that he is talking to somebody who is familiar with, who he is used to negotiating with. He gets straight to the point. He says, hey, short trial or resolution? Which one? She says, resolution. And he settled the case for $10,000. I, in turn, find out about this, and I call and I email Mr. Storm immediately saying, hey, I'm so happy that we get this done. Send me your release. Here's my W-9. And, of course, it results in being interested in from you.
I'm not clear how you make a distinction, though, in this context about whether counsel is representing Key Insurance by your own acknowledgement. They're direct employees. So I'm not sure there is a distinction. At least I'm not following it with Yellow Cab. I recognize Yellow Cab had retained counsel, but here these folks are directly employed by the insurance company. And they not only represent their insureds, but are working for, and in that context, represent the insurance company. I don't know that representation is a great place to be trying to make a distinction here.
Well, I think it's retention versus employment. If there is no tripartite relationship between his employees and their insurers, as opposed to somebody who's retained where they have a specific agreement saying, okay, I'm being hired by you, insurance company, for this case. I have duties to the client, but I also have duties to you. That's spelled out in the pension. That's not something that's spelled out in employment. It's as a different employment contract. Now, but their employment contracts, they even exist. I'm just saying generally, retained, when attorneys retain, they have control over what the scope of their representation is. When you're employed by an insurance company, handling the case day in and day out, just taking all that are after going to litigation, they are the go-to. They're the ones that the case gets shipped down the hall to. There's no decision-making process. Okay, here's a new file. I'm going to file an answer. I'm going to get going.
Along the lines of my question to counsel about the propriety of the adjuster having contacted their attorney to say opposing counsel reached out about settling the case, why would you not contact counsel first to say, do you mind if I talk to the adjuster, see if we can get the, especially in a situation like this where the arbitration rules mandate that the court enforce the arbitration award if nobody files a timely request for trial de novo, which is kind of the situation we ended up with here.
I understand your question, Your Honor. I appreciate the question. The answer that I have is that speaking to my partner after giving the award and discussing 9 days later, because I have talked to him about it either, he had a relationship with Mr. Bonsett. It was routine. It was nothing out of the ordinary to say, I'm going to just go ahead and call Mr. Bonsett to dialogue.
But it's vastly different to have a relationship with an insurance representative because so many cases get settled before there's ever anything filed in court. But once you're in court and you've got identifiable parties and attorneys involved, it seems that it would be more prudent to contact counsel to talk about resolving the case that counsel represents somebody on.
Your Honor, I can't disagree with the comment about being more prudent. Does it rise to the level of avoiding a settlement? It's a right to the level of there's nothing nefarious about the communication, I can tell you that. Mr. Montes had an opportunity to say, after reviewing the notes, let me go ahead and discuss with Mr. Storm on the break. Right? She didn't have to. That wasn't her MO. That wasn't what he required her to do either. But if you see, if you're going back to the transcript again, or the audio of the telephone, Mr. Pieper says, we're going to file a request for short trial. I want to see if it's done. She doesn't even comment on it. She doesn't ask, well, what's the short trial? She doesn't say, well, wait a second, what's the status of the litigation? She, business as usual, gets right into her notes. Let me see what we can do. Okay, we can get this done for $10,000.
Counsel, I have two questions.
Yes,
outside of that. So first, can you draw a meaningful distinction between in-house counsel in this context and a private counsel that may have been retained by an insurance company for purposes of analysis of a 4.2 situation? And the second question is, if this court were to conclude there's a violation of 4.2, does that affect whether or not the judge abused her discretion in granting the 60B motion?
If I could take your second question.
Please.
No, I don't think it does the very first section of the NRPC 1.08B, it actually states specifically that appellant shouldn't be allowed to use 4.2 even if the rule violated the strongly argued here, that's from the criticism. It shouldn't be allowed to use that as a sword in order to undermine the enforceability of the valid number of going back to your first question, I think the distinction is they can't be considered a representative party. He cannot be considered a representative party since they're the only employee, not in the council, who reports to the adjuster, the shop caller in this case. Going back to my discussion about the difference between retention and employment, key employees don't have the freedom, for lack of a better term, that anyone else might have. They don't have the ability to say, no, I'm not going to represent this client case of the sign and talk to them and do the work. They don't have the ability as an independent counsel and only hire retained counsel and retention is the word that Nevada Health uses. Doesn't that ever mention 4.2 or its predecessor or substitute 4.2? So the difference between being employed and retained is that ability to make it independent. This is my first time here. I don't know what that bell meant.
You've got more time. Sure. You've got a minute and 15 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. There wasn't really discussion by Mr. Vinci today, but it's in his briefs about NAR 18 and 19. We don't even get there. As soon as we had a settlement on February 20th, 2020, those rules were inapplicable and irrelevant. So in discussion based upon our reported failure to file and request for child notice in 30 days, it is irrelevant because we avoided having to comply with that rule by 7-8. And the subsequent order that was filed under NIAR 19 that Mr. Storm filed is also, should be set aside. It was set aside by Judge Al in her sound discretion because she recognized that as of 2-20-2020, the only thing that needed to be done was getting the closing documents. Closing the case out when they are 18 and 19 federal rules any longer. At the end, Your Honor, Appellant simply has not met his burden showed that the district court abused her discretion and therefore, which is our belief, not conclude that the district court manifestly abused her discretion or granted that settlement agreement.
All right, Mr. Crafton, thank you for your argument. Thank you, Mr. Vinci, for your argument. The case will stand submitted, and we will invite counsel in.